Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, to the NIDS View, the weekly show that gives you deterrence like you just wouldn't believe. And I'm here, your host, Jim Petrosky, along with the great and venerable Curtis McGiffin.
I don't know.
Say
about
hi,
great.
Everyone, Curtis.
Hi, everyone.
So today we're going to talk about something really exciting. I got to start out with a song that you may not have heard by Tom Fenton Ice Nine.
You're going to sing?
Here we go. I'll be down to see you in the fallout shelter, baby. You better be ready about half past 1983. Why do I bring that up? Because today we're going to talk about resilience, survivability, and how it affects deterrence. And the reason we're doing that actually is multiple reasons, because the United States has really gotten away from looking at our ability to survive an attack in our area. And what we're seeing is responses in Europe to the Russian aggression in their area and what they're doing about it. We're going to talk about that today. And as a matter of fact, if you aren't aware of Russia doing that, go back and listen to our YouTube channel on our HUSI events, because we just recently, last Friday, had an excellent, excellent seminar by Dr. Philip Carber, who discussed the Russian tactical nuclear weapons. And it was somewhat eye-opening. I was surprised that Russia had so many tactical nuclear weapons. Curtis, was that new to you as well? I mean, there's so much great information in that cast.
Yeah, Dr. Carber's awesome. I'm not surprised. What frustrates me about these things is that I think the numbers are consistently underreported. The sort of working number is 2,000 Russian tactical nuclear weapons. And they sort of euphemistically say that it's 90 times greater than our number, that sort of thing, whatever the case may be. And I just think it's a drastically underreported number. And there's been several articles out by Dr. Mark Schneider of the National Institute for Public Policy, who's documented from different interviews over the years that really lead him to believe that there's closer to 6,000 to 8,000. So it really depends on how you're counting and what you're counting. But it is probably more than 2,000.
Yeah. It's amazing though, having a threat on your border, how that changes the way you look at what's going to happen in your country and how you respond. And we're seeing, you know, countries like Finland. So we'll talk a little bit about Finland, who is now claiming to have enough fallout shelters for their entire population because they wish to be resilient, survive, and, you know, retain their way of life. And, you know, I was recently talking to someone, about this very subject, because I'm passionate about it, because I believe that as American citizenry, we've taken away our responsibility. We think the government's just going to come in at the last minute and do something if something were to happen in the United States. And it's a bad position to be in, not from a defense standpoint. I wish we didn't have to worry about it, but from a deterrence standpoint, because the Russian government sees us, you know, Putin sees us and says, this might be a soft target. Maybe it's not yet today. Maybe it is yesterday. I don't know what the Russian word for yes is, so I just used yet, though. What's that?
Da?
Da? Okay, there you go. Well, that's how much I get out. So what's interesting is I often hear, well, we don't want to build shelters because then it seems like we've failed. And so I have a question for you, Curtis, to sort of start the discussion. When you get in your car, do you put on a seatbelt?
Of course, because that's the law.
That's the law. Okay. Very. All right. Well, if it weren't the law, would you think of putting on a seatbelt?
You know, I'm a safety conscious kind of guy. I think I'm the kind of guy, as I hope many of our listeners are, when I mow the lawn, I wear hearing protection. I'm definitely, if I'm doing something out in the street, I have an orange cone that I put out, to warn drivers and these sorts of things. So I am very safety conscious. I think my military background really brought me up to that. And I think preparation is key, because I can't use an orange cone to warn oncoming traffic that I'm out in the road doing something if I didn't buy one in advance, store it in the right place, right? Have it in an operational condition and available for me to use when I needed it, which might only be 2 or 3 times a year.
So I absolutely agree. And that's a great analogy, but I'm going to take it one step further before I sort of turn this over to you, because I can see you're ready to jump on something here. But here's a question for you. When you put that orange cone out, are you inviting people to run over you? Or are you telling them, I don't want you to run over me. I want you to take a different path or, you know, a different method of driving when you're around my street side?
Well, obviously it's the latter, but also because I have the orange cone out, hopefully I'll get a better insurance settlement if it does hit me.
Well, that's never thought of it that way. That's how do I turn that into national policy? I'm not sure, but that's okay.
Well, I think what it is, protection comes at a price. Yes. And it's a number of issues. And, but before we press forward, because I want to just sort of equate for our listeners, you know, for the Russians and their quote unquote tactical nuclear weapons, or what we often refer to as non-strategic nuclear weapons, for them there's not really a difference in the way compared to the way that we think about it in America, because Russia views NATO, including the United States, but NATO as its foremost strategic threat. And it doesn't use geography to divide its strategic threat. And so what it has is different tools to deter its strategic threat. And that strategic threat is both far away for ICBMs like the United States and close in for the smaller missiles, the shorter range missiles, and the everything down to what the nuclear artillery that you're familiar with, Jim. I think you dropped one on your foot at some point when you were 19. And essentially it has the same purpose, which is to protect and deter attacks on the Russian homeland, right? Because it's just a matter of that geography playing a role there. And so the systems, I don't think they really separate in a philosophical way the way we do, of sort of, we sort of siloed, these are our strategic systems and these are our tactical systems. And oh, by the way, any use of even a tactical nuclear weapon has a strategic implication. That's our view. That's not their view. And so this is why countries like Finland and the Baltics and Poland and others are working hard to prepare themselves for the eventuality. They are on the battle lines, right? They are there in this bad neighborhood, so to speak, and they've got to have the right kinds of fences and locked doors and protective things in order to ensure that the bad guys don't get into their homes. Another analogy for you.
Yeah, no, very, very good. And, you know, that's the one thing that I think is different. Now, we're talking about preparedness because of an attack, but deterrence is we want to deter the attack. And your analogy, I wish we had done this in the show prep. I actually would have prepared it differently, but you hit it exactly right. When I talk about a seatbelt, and I put it on for driving a car, and we'll get back to the countries in a second, but I want to finish my analogy just because I prepped for it and I want the audience to get the full the full piece of this, right? No, but when you put on a seatbelt, it's not like I'm inviting an accident, okay? And it also doesn't stop the accident, which is the problem, is that, you know, that's defense. Defense is I have something on, and when something happens, you know, survive, I have to survive that. But deterrence is sort of what you're doing. You put the cone out to say, don't come over on this side. You're changing the driver around you. You're changing the direction they're going to travel, or you change your speed, et cetera. And that's the good analogy, the difference between a defense, the seatbelt, which I'm going to wear because it's the law. Thank you for reminding me. And also, it's going to, if I get in an accident, but it doesn't invite an accident. And you putting the cone out doesn't invite someone to drive poorly, but it actually is more of a deterrence because it changes the way they're going to drive, hopefully, or at least your insurance, the amount that you're going to get. So somewhat of a deterrence in terms of loss of money. But I think that's where the confusion often comes up when people talk about, you know, taking some responsibility for survivability and resilience from us. They're thinking, oh, that's just a defensive measure and we're not going to get attacked. But it also is a signal, like your red orange cone. It's a signal to others to say, we are going, you know, we have a plan. You've planned in advance. We have a plan. We're doing something and you're not going to be successful. That's the turns part of this, where the fallout shelters, the preparation. I don't know if the audience in the YouTube can see behind me. If you've ever seen me on talks, I always keep civil defense monitors behind me because it's a constant reminder that at one time, where that song came from, the fallout shelter song, back in the 1980s, we still had people building fallout shelters and putting out, you know, things to survive a nuclear attack. And oh, by the way, a fallout shelter is not just for nuclear. I mean, if there's a tornado in Ohio, I probably would climb into my fallout shelter. I'm not sure I'd need to take iodine pills to overcome any fallout, but that's the different issue. The point is that deterrence is not just the defense part. It's the signaling to our adversary, you know, one of the Curtis McGiffin's vitamin C's, you know, communicating that we are serious about surviving and continuing along. And so I think that's what I saw when, you know, looking at an article that, you know, Curtis and I read in the show prep about Finland and the U.S. just having a total defense strategy to signal to our adversaries that we're serious about defending our homeland and maintaining our way of life. And I think we've gotten far away from that. I really do. At least personally, the average American citizenry, I know we have a great military. We have, you know, we're putting up a Iron Dome or Golden Dome, whichever one you prefer to put up. But that, you know, that protection is going to be very useful for deterring attacks on us. What do you think, Curtis, about the defense part of this?
Yeah. So, you know, this is what we in the deterrence world refer to as damage limitation. And so resilience, which can be defined as a nation's ability to withstand, adapt to, and recover from crises, an attack, a natural disaster, an economic disaster. Sometimes those could be caused kinetically or cyber. So there's a whole bunch of different ways that, you know, that our societal standing can be impacted, and resilience can play a role in that. And in the deterrence vernacular, resilience plays a role in this damage limitation. It started in the Cold War, you know, civil defense shelters and duck and cover, and, you know, these sort of information awareness campaigns that mobilize and educate citizens of what to do. And of course, in the 50s, we had this sort of idea that you can build a bomb shelter in your backyard, and many homes did. And of course, any basement can become a moniker of a shelter in that regard. But it's important to understand how that plays out. And so there's a lot of work that goes into this. And so, you know, when I talk about this with my students, I have a whole lesson on this, and I'll share with you just a little bit here, a little freebie for the viewers. And so thinking about this kind of work, this sort of civil defense, it's what we often refer to in the biz as passive damage limitation or passive defense, whereas the active side of damage limitation would be your ballistic missile defense. Think Golden Dome, air interceptors, you know, to intercept bombers or cruise missiles or drones now, and your anti-submarine warfare activities that go out there and try to hunt down the adversary, the enemy submarines, before they can launch nuclear missiles upon you. That's sort of the active stuff. You're out there doing it, right? And the passive stuff is sort of the things we do. It sort of builds in natural protection. And so what I do is I teach what are called, and you're going to love this, Jim, because you've never heard this from me before. It is the four P's of passive deterrence. And passive defense and deterrence. The first P is what I call provision. You've got to have the things, right? And you've got to make them work. You've got to have them loaded up with the things that they need. And then, of course, you have You have preparation, which is not an, it's not that you just don't have it, but you've got to have it in place. You've got to make sure it stays, you know, fresh, and it, you know, there's expiration dates, and you've got to do those sorts of things. The third one is practice. If you don't practice your civil defense maneuvers, if you don't exercise bug out routines and austere maintenance and these sorts of things, you're not going to get there. And provision, of course, made sure under that PE rule that we had the backup equipment and things, right, to do that. And then the final thing is, the final P is persistence. If we don't consistently and persistently think about this and do it and maintain it, and don't let the politics of the day dissuade you from it, or let goofy policies decide that that is an expense we don't want to pay for anymore, then your persistency ends, which affects the other three P's as you go down the line. So those are the four P's of passive defense. And I think if we think about these problem sets and those in using that sort of easy way, we can go a lot farther in preparing, enhancing our resilience.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's not a whole lot of things. First of all, I love the four P's. I think that's great. You know, I always, when I do EMP, especially discussions with the military and with industries and businesses, you know, I always tell them that, you know, one of the most overlooked things is that they spend a lot of money in purchasing all this EMP equipment, and then they don't maintain it, right, and they don't update it, and they don't do those parts of it, and they're often overlooked. They do it once. The persistence is really, really important. So thanks to you, and hopefully our audience will be able to talk about that as well. That's a good takeaway. But you know, we look at this, we look at these concepts of, you know, sort of resilience to attack. But what we don't, I don't think what we appreciate is still that signal. You know, it comes from the communications. We are ready, and that, you know, especially when you get to nuclear, you know, these can be used for many things. You know, a tornado hits, a hurricane, we have a famine, you got food in your fallout shelter, you're able to survive a period of time. You know, all those things may happen. I won't say famine, maybe some reason why you can't get to the store, or your local grocery store, you know, is destroyed by water or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, the point is that these things are have multiple uses for survivability. But what also is important when people think of nuclear is they say, well, you know, a nuclear bomb goes off, we're all dead. It's really not true. A shelter, especially an underground shelter, can provide a lot of protection. You know, I remember when I was in high school, and for those of you, yes, I'm an older person, so the newer school announcements, as I hear from my grandkids, is today we're going to have a windy day, so school's closed. Whereas when we were in school, it was, there's a tornado outside, go to the hall, lean against the wall, put a book over your head, and we're having pizza for lunch. I mean, just, you know, it was just a thing that happened, right? So there's slightly different way in which we look at the world.
Pizza for lunch? Wow.
Yeah, pizza for lunch. We always had pizza for lunch. Anyway, but my point is it's very survivable. I mean, it was very survivable to get against the wall, away from the windows where shattered glass could hit people. You know, same with fallout. You know, you can get into a fallout shelter. You survive the first, you know, 10 or so hours after a nuclear weapon goes off near you. You know, you've reduced, you know, the amount of radiation that you will come in contact with once you get out of it if you need to. And if you have, you know, HVAC and you have food and everything else, you can survive a long time. And the point of that is that it is not an all lost cause if you are prepared. Now, if you're unprepared, if you're standing out in the middle of a field and a nuclear weapon goes off near you, well, sorry, you're done. So you have to prepare. You have to communicate in the country. You have to have all these things and practice this process, which is the other piece that you talked about. You have to practice what to do. You know, where do you go? What do? How long do you stay? Even, you know, we talked about the, you know, communicating what you do, how long do you stay underground? How long do you do these things? These are things we talk about at our NIDS Knowledge podcast, bring up, you know, how long you should wait, what timing you have, because it is a survivable event. And we need to be able to survive. We're to continue. You know, Curtis, you talked about, I want to throw this because you always like throwing out readings that you have. The National Security Strategy from 2017, I just liked what it had, because one thing, and the first place I saw this is that resilience, which is what we're talking about, mm-hmm. the ability to withstand and recover rapidly from deliberate attacks, accidents, natural disasters. They all go together because this, you know, this concept can be used for all of them, as well as unconventional stresses, shocks, and threats to our economy and democratic system. So just economy and democratic system. So it encompasses all that. And I never heard it that way before. I thought it was rather interesting to put it that way. And I wanted to sort of add that to your definition you had there. You think about it.
Well, I think so. There's in national resilience, there's a lot to the psychological aspect of that, mm-hmm. And I think making sure that the surviving citizens, let's assume it's a kinetic, you know, nuclear attack or you mm-hmm. know something like that, or a cyber attack that shuts everything down, or an EMP attack that shuts everything down, is that you've got to make sure that the citizens believe that the federal government can and still function, and the state governments can and still function, and not only work to repair, mitigate, and you know try to restore lost critical infrastructure, but that in the meantime, that things can be done to ensure civil society remains civil.
Oh yeah.
And what you don't want is that within a couple of weeks, you know, we're killing each other for an old rusty can of peaches. So these things matter. And that's where I think we have to look at what I think is the next thing. So we look with civil defense, big deal, but we also can't forget what I think are two other key aspects, and maybe we can spend a little time delving into these. I think you'll be interested. One of them is for our military is having dispersed and ready forces. If we spread out some of our military and our recovery forces out to the hinterlands of the United States, it's harder to target them, and then these things can sort of be brought back in. I think that's part of that provisioning aspect of what's going on. And the other one is hardening your infrastructure. And this is where I think you'll really bite in and tear at here on this one. The hardening of the infrastructure, not only just, you know, bunkers and shelters and things like that, but, you know, EMP hardening of the electrical grid, being able to repair kinetic separations, you know, things that get blown up and now you've got to fix these lines of communication and these sorts of things. And of course, the shielding from electromagnetic pulse, not only just the hardening of the electronics writ large, but even just your things at home, you know, how to put a Faraday cage around things, you know, whether or not it goes in. People, this isn't really a prepper's podcast, but there's a lot to what preppers do that think about these. And I think if every individual or individual family took at least control of what they could, be responsible for what you can control, I think it makes the overall national resiliency more efficient, because you're one less person or one less family that the state has to worry about and then that the feds have to worry about. You know, again, as they always say, you know, when your emergency, the rescue to your emergency is minutes away, seconds matter. And if you're not prepared to deal with it yourself, you're probably going to suffer more.
Yeah, no, you know, I appreciate that. You gave me a lot to unpack and what's left here in time. But maybe this will be follow on. You know, we're going to focus a lot more on resiliency and survivability in 2026 as we look at a couple themes in NIDS. But I want to cover a couple things. You said, you know, you want to have the citizenry with the confidence that the government is going to be able to make things happen. And I think there is a little bit of a conundrum. As I go back, you know, jokingly at the beginning with the song, you know, the fallout shelter is when I go around and talk to people about fallout shelters or preparing, and your sort of snide remark about preppers, because, you know, I tell people, you know, I have three wells on my property. Two of them have electric pumps. One has a hand pump because I want to be able to survive, because water is essential. And so I have an extra well on my property that I can hand pump. And people go, oh, you're a prepper, like it's a negative. And I go, no, I'm prepared. There's a difference. I'm not hiding in the bushes. Well, at least as far as people know, I'm not hiding in the bushes waiting for someone to attack my property. But, you know, I always say, though, if something were to happen, I'm prepared to survive it as best I can. And my family and I do practice it. We actually go out and, you know, bring in the water every once in a while. while, or when the power goes off, we work it out. And so I think the conundrum is when you're doing that preparation, people think, oh, we failed, which I think we need to change the national narrative. No, we didn't fail. We care. And we care. The government cares enough to help, for you to take care of. Maybe there should be incentives for you to put in a shelter or build a survivable box, these civil defense monitors. There were millions and millions of those. By the way, when I started up NIDS, for the audience to know, and Curtis, this, when I started up NIDS, I wanted to give everyone a gift, for the startup. And I went out and found this one civil defense monitor that I have in my office. And I said, I'm going to buy one of those for everybody to remind them about our civil defense in times when we thought about nuclear. And I went out to buy them from a company, and the company said, we're sold out. And I said, what do you mean you're sold out? Where'd they go? They said the Russians bought them. They said there's a Russian company that bought out all that we had. And there were millions of these around, and they were swallowed up. I got mine at a yard sale, and I can't find any more yard sales with them. Anyway, going back to this, though, the citizenry has to know that the government cares, but then they have to also take personal responsibility. And your personal responsibility gives the government and your neighbors and everyone else the relief of not having to take care of you and makes you available to take care of them. The second thing that you talked about, the EMP shielding part, so there's another part, is that infrastructure costs when you redo infrastructure. So you should have this in your thought. For example, I had my power put underground. Why? Because every time we had a windstorm, I lost power at my house because the trees would knock down the power lines. So I had it put underground from the road to my house. And when I did that, I said, well, while I'm doing that, let me put in a sub nanosecond lightning suppressor. I mean, it was an extra $200 on top of a modest amount of money to have everything put underground. But the point was the add-on to make my house protected from this surge of energy that would come from an EMP. I went sub nanosecond so I could get the EMP too and the lightning. It was very low cost, very cheap. I don't have to do much. There's not much maintenance to it. I have it checked once a year by pushing a button and it says test, and a little yellow light comes on, and I push the other button and the yellow light turns off. Very simple to build it in. And as we update neighborhoods, as we update, systems like power lines, you probably driving around seeing power lines up and down around your house. We should invest as a country to put our power lines underground, to build that EMP suppression, to put that in as we move along. And then you talked about, so the other piece I want to unpack here real quickly is, if for all of us that lived through the 1980s, we went through the BRAC process. What was the BRAC? Well, base realignment and consolidation. We did the exact opposite of what we should do to be a survivable nation. We took our military installations and we consolidated them all for convenience and economy. I get that. Mm-hmm. But there's a cost involved in that because now you have a single target and a single location. And that that reduces or increases our vulnerability. And so, we as a nation need to look at our survivable capabilities. Instead of being consolidated, maybe spread out. Will cost a little bit more, but it'll cost a little bit more in the short run. But imagine how much better that is than going to war. As Adam always says when he's on this podcast, Adam will always say, war costs you twice. Right? You got to pay for it once to fight the war and once to rebuild afterwards. Okay, so it's legal to cost you twice, maybe even three times. This is a cheap, inexpensive solution with a little bit of forethought.
So Adam always says that twice because he's quoting me.
Okay.
I agree with you. And I think this is when I talked, when I mentioned earlier, we can't have silly policies and naive outlooks into the future to ruin the persistence of what we need. And BRAC in the 80s and 90s is a great example of how we have lost the ability to disperse forces and enhance and increase the chances of survivability. And also, by the way, it consumes more of the adversary's warheads should they be actually adhering to any nuclear treaty that we might have with them. And so the challenge here is that, look, national security isn't cheap, and it's difficult to figure out, if you cut it up into 330 million slices, how much your slice is and how much you're responsible for it. But the reality here is that it is a much cheaper cost than waging war writ large. And resiliency is actually pretty cheap in comparison to an active defense. Is passive defense much cheaper than an active defense? That doesn't mean that you shouldn't have both. But here's the thing, Jim, when we look at it from a deterrence perspective, this resiliency idea is really an interlocutor between deterrence by denial and deterrence by punishment. And so what we're saying here is that, you know, deterrence by denial is the things that you do, whether they're active or passive, as we've already defined, that make success unachievable by the adversary, right? I can't win this. I can't beat this. They've got too many obstacles in the way. Therefore, I'm not going to try in the first place. I am deterred. That's how that sort of works. Punishment, on the other side, says don't do it because you won't be successful enough, and what we have left is going to destroy you in such a way that is intolerable to you. Therefore, striking first, I'm afraid to. Right. So you look at Dr. Strangelove's definition of deterrence. It's the fear to attack. Right. I'm afraid to attack you because of the retaliation that's coming. Well, the reason why that second strike retaliation survives or is credible is based on how strong your denial, your aspects are, which includes all of this damage limitation. You really can't do one without the other. And the connection between the two is resilience. Because if our policy, and I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but if our policy is, as a nation, is to withstand the first strike, right, to have nuclear laydowns all over this country, and then decide, hey, Jim, I think we've been attacked. We should try to retaliate now. Then you've got to have enough left over that survived that you can then turn around and launch. Resilience is the key to that. Because while denial will work in some aspects, it's not going to shoot everything down. It's not going to stop and prevent every activity from detonating, so to speak. But resilience is what's left. And if you don't have a resilient infrastructure in which to order the retaliation, for example, and actually be able to carry it out, then they've won. So national resilience plays a key role in all of that. Jim, as you close us out here, I want to throw one last one in here for us to think about, and that is energy resilience.
Oh, yes.
Energy resilience is a key aspect to our national security. And, you know, we've got a lot of new technology coming out here. I'm pretty confident that the solar panels and the windmills will come down pretty easy with the blast and overpressure of your average nuclear weapon. But the possibility of smaller generation and these sorts of things, like this new technology of these microreactors and things like that, these may be key opportunities as we begin to focus more on resilience that we could offer as an idea for this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I've given a lot of thought to this. I am pro-nuclear power. I think, we are at the age right now where the time has come, and we need to see that nuclear renaissance that many of us have looked at in the past. So let me talk about three aspects of that: small modular reactors that most people don't think about. One, small modular reactors take up a very small footprint, you know, and a podcast, and I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but you have acres and acres of space taken up to build a solar panel that is extremely sensitive to hail, let alone nuclear weapon blast and shock. And same with windmills, which we're finding out many are being taken down because of the maintenance requirements for them. High maintenance cost, and even delivery and replacement is extremely expensive. Small modular reactors can be built. They can be built to run for 20 years on one fueling. Mm-hmm. So imagine the resilience of something. Not only is it a small target, that's step one, but number two is that as a small target, you aren't be held by some supplier for 20 years after you've fueled it up. Imagine that. I mean, that's why submarines, again, I've said this before, submarines go underwater. They don't have to keep coming up to be refueled. They can last a long time. We can build a reactor in your community that is running consistently. And then the third piece of the small modular reactors, and why I like them, and I know for many years we went with large reactors to build cities or to cover cities, is easy to maintain, easy to control, easy to operate. And being modular, if your city does increase a need in power, base power, we talk about, you know, flat load power, the things you need all the time, you could just add another one onto the same footprint with the same infrastructure. And so it's a very easy way to change things out if we did have a change in power need for something like a data center. I mean, we're looking at the future. We have data centers going up all around, or a new infrastructure for manufacturing of equipment. During wartime, we have to amplify our manufacturing capability. Mm. The ability to add and subtract is very quick with the modular reactors. Most people do not see that piece of it. Right. And so you have these very safe, small targets designed. Again, we've had nuclear reactors or radioactive materials and reactors that have fallen out of the sky from nuclear materials that are in the sky, landed on the ground, crashed, burned, no release. If we can drop it from the sky, we can leave it on the ground and it's going to survive. Right. And they're very, very safe and operable. Yeah, go ahead, Curtis.
Can these reactors be made EMP hardened?
Well, again, a nuclear reactor, the reactor itself is untouched by the EMP piece. Now, the power generation side of it, the electrical generation side of it, is the same. If you listen to my NIDS podcast, you take our NIDS Knowledge podcast. If you take a coal reactor and a nuclear reactor and a gas reactor, they all have the same electrical side components. It's only the power source that changes. Maybe someday, and we have looked at this to be EMP hardened, it's still not going to change much from the production standpoint, but you can use what are called thermoelectrics, where you use the heat differential from the inside to the outside to produce electricity. And then you don't have the large generator, and that is completely EMP resilient. And there's nothing about, you know, that's going to harm anything. And that's what they're looking at for deep space missions. That's why deep space, you know, studies are really good, because you're learning how to do these things. So you can do a deep space mission concept on the ground. But then once you get to the electrical power grid, it's still difficult from a generation standpoint. But again, you build all this underground, you put your power lines underground, you run it into your homes underground, and there's very little that the EMP is going to, you know, to damage. And again, if it's built into the system up front, it's fairly inexpensive. It's when you want to tear down power lines, cut holes in the ground where houses are, move streets over, move streets back, you know, cut up sidewalks. Those are the things that cause problems when you reinvest, because it's very, very expensive. You know, and that's the problem. I mean, imagine if you wanted to have a houseboat. So you took your house and you started sealing it up because you wanted it on the water. Okay, it'd be very expensive. Just build a houseboat from scratch. Okay. And so it's much better. It might not have the room you have in your nice palatial place there in Tennessee, Curtis, but a houseboat, though, is better built from the ground up than, you know, taking your house and converting it into a boat.
Yeah, certainly. Well, the part of the problem here is I live in a fairly new community where all of our power is underground. That's with great. All the power that's coming into the community, not so much. So when we lose power, which we do, it's all because, you know, some wind or some squirrel got in the way and disrupted power, you know, in the rural lands feeding into our more modern, you know, if you will, newly built community. And so that's the issue, I think, is that if you go through a national program of burying all the power lines, as you mentioned earlier in the podcast, kind of similar to what we did in the 80s, where we laid, you know, millions of miles of coaxial cable, right, to bring the United States into the 21st century.
So we
could watch HBO, and all this. Yep. So the point here is that it would take a national priority, right? It would be a huge undertaking,
To our leadership out there, to remember, it's not a failure, your failure, that we're doing this. It's you protecting us doing it. And I hear this oftentimes when I talk to people about this. Like, well, if we start doing this, you know, people are going to think we failed. No, we got to change the national narrative. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's a technology change and a modern change. And the reality here is what I was going to lastly say is that it's an aesthetic change. I tell you, there's nothing uglier than driving down a street with all these power lines crisscrossing. We don't have phone lines anymore, Jim. Nobody's running copper anymore. So all these, you know, for the most part, these are power lines that could, once buried, would make the whole community look a lot nicer everywhere in the country.
Yeah, and then maybe you could get rid of that law and have your seatbelt because you won't run into a phone pole.
Right? Oh, okay. Well, the trees will still be there. But oh, yes.
Okay, never mind. All right. Well, I was just trying to find a safety effort. All right. Well, you know, we've come to the end of the podcast today. Hopefully, you will walk away from things. Again, Curtis, give us your four P's again. I want to recap that.
Four P's of passive defense are provision, preparation, practice, and persistence. So you got to have it. Then you've got to prepare it. You got to place it, that sort of thing. Then you've got to practice. You've got to rehearse what you need to do so that you're familiar with all of this equipment and these sorts of things. And lastly, you must be persistent in it, not only in your policies, but in the other three P's. You can't ever stop practicing. You got to swap out those provisions, you know. So, you know, rice is only good for so many years, right? and then finally, you know, you just in that preparation mindset in that regard. So the four P's, there you go.
Well, good. Well, thank you very much, Curtis. I really like that. And thank you so much for all you put into this this podcast. Thank you to our listeners and thank you to our sponsors. We can't live without you. For our listeners and our sponsors, get the word out on our podcast. Let them know that we exist. Let your friends know. We'd like to pick up a lot more audience because we think this is valuable for our communities, for our citizenry, for our leadership, for everyone. We have other things that we do aside from podcasts. We do seminars almost every other Friday. Contact us at nids@thinkdeterrence.com. We'll get you on the list, get you on the invite, let you interact with us there. We still are publishing on our GSR, Global Security Review, our online journal with hard-hitting factual information about the events that are occurring in the United States and how deterrence figures into that. So we stay at peace and we continue to have the great prosperity and the great lifestyle we have in these great United States. And so I thank everyone for being a part of this. And I rarely do this. I keep forgetting. Kimberly Charrington, our podcast producer, just does a wonderful job of getting these things out into the media on YouTube and onto our site at thinkdeterrence.com. And so she does a great job of getting out there. So if you miss an episode or want to talk about one of these episodes at home with your family, listen to this, talk about resilience, what you can do, and give us feedback at nids@thinkdeterrence.com. And as always, we are asking you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.